is hauntingly beautiful. The first reading this morning is an Eastern European folktale, meaning that there does not seem to be an official version dating from about 200 years ago. We just know that it started around that time. Scholars think that the main idea in this story comes from the Hasidic rabbi Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev.
There once was a man who had told many terrible lies about the local rabbi. As Yom Kippur approached, he was finally overcome by remorse. He went to the rabbi and begged his forgiveness. The rabbi cheerfully forgave him, but this did not altogether ease the man's conscience. "Rabbi," he pleaded, "tell me how I can make amends for the wrongs I have done." The rabbi sighed and said, "Here's what you do. Take two pillows, go to the public square, and there cut the pillows open. Then wave them in the air. Then come back here when you're done." Quickly, the sorry man went home, got two fine pillows and a knife, hastened to the square, cut the pillows open, waved them in the air, and hurried back to the rabbi's house. "I did just what you said, Rabbi." "Good. Now go back to the square." The man said, "Yes?" "And collect all your feathers."
The second reading this morning is the poem "Happiness is Harder" by the poet Jane Hirschfield, written in 2001. Jane Hirschfield grew up in New York in a Jewish family, but has been a Zen Buddhist practitioner and teacher for most of her life, and is a popular workshop leader.
To read a book of poetry from back to front, there is the cure for certain kinds of sadness. A person has only to choose what doesn't matter. Just that. That coffee. This dress. Here is the time I would like to arrive. Today I will wash the windows. Consider the master's description of awakened existence. How seemingly simple. Hungry, I eat. Sleepy, I sleep. Is this choosing completely or not at all? In either case, everything seems to conspire against it.
Thank you.
on the way to the office here yesterday to work on this sermon, I stopped by to see a friend. He had just moved into a new place, and he was anxious to show me the new digs. I have to say, I think his place is a treasure that he found here in Columbus. Small but elegant, well designed, well cared for, charming in every possible way. Afterward, as we stood on the porch, the letter carrier walked past and dropped off a stack of mail. One piece of mail was from the bank. The bank said, when he opened the letter, that he owed $1,045 on his credit card bill. The thing is, my friend does not have a credit card at that bank. I looked at the bill. Everything looked right. The name, the form of the bill, the amount, all printed neatly. It cost someone something to make that and mail it. But of course, it was a scam. One of many that come our ways these days, via computer, via mail, via telephone. And my friend is going to have to waste some of his precious time this week dealing with this nonsense. Now, as far as I was concerned, he took it very well. There was no agitation, no yelling, just an expression of mild surprise that these things happen at all. On the other hand, I was just fuming. Not only am I resentful that I myself have to deal with such nonsense frequently, but my friend's scam brought up a tough time during my summer. I'm not talking now about the almost daily scams on the computer or on my phone. Free vacation in the Bahamas, just call us up. You signed up for it, don't you remember? Thanks for signing up for our religious fanatic I hate just about everyone site. No, I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about the deep hurt in my heart, caused by the actions of a very real person in my life who I thought was becoming a friend. The hurt arose from an experience of financial loss, a sense of betrayal, and even a sense of red-faced shame and embarrassment on my part that I didn't see it coming. I, who fancy myself as being pretty good at what's often called street smarts. The depth of my angry response really surprised me. Plenty of uncharacteristic bile and inappropriate language. I went around diagnosing this person as a sociopath without benefit of any diagnostic education. I used theological labels like devil and spawn of hell, even though such language is not really part of my theology. And I found myself deeply depressed for a while, since depression sometimes, as many of you know, can sometimes be just a form of anger turned inward against oneself. How could I have not seen this coming? And at the end of all this ranting and raving, I was the one who felt sinful. Now, don't go off half loony on me because I just used a word that I rarely use around here. Along with the skeptical philosopher Bertrand Russell, I too have spent much of my life baffled by the usage of the word sin, so often defined by common usage as any act that makes a very, very micromanaging God very angry for hard-to-understand reasons. However, I have to say I was completely grabbed by David Roberts' understanding of this poorly used term. Sin, he says, at its roots, is simply ingratitude. It is sort of a seizure of life, as though by right, instead of receiving it as a gift. I think that's brilliant. As though by right, he says. I think the word I use a lot these days that says the same thing is entitlement. I felt sinful because I was feeling a sense of entitlement this summer. I seem to have been thinking that as a guy who tries hard to do some good in the world, to be there for those in need, I therefore had the right, I was entitled, that nothing embarrassing or nasty should ever befall me. I felt deep inside that I had the right to never be betrayed. I was entitled to good behavior only. Everyone should only tell me the truth. No one should ever lie to me or take advantage of me or scam me or take precious things from me. But then one day, lucky me, I chanced to find a beautiful greeting card at a gift shop. It was a simple black square with white lettering. As a matter of fact, you can see it up there on the top. Come up and look at it later if you want. The letters reveal a poem by the great Japanese poet Musita Masahide. Here's the poem. Barns burnt down now, and now I can see the moon. The poem hit me like a slap. And to my surprise, right then and right there, my anger and my sense of entitlement began to ebb, began to slowly fade away. You see, I remembered then that I don't have any special privileges, special title to a barn, a storehouse, a safe house, where my heart is going to be for all time and permanently protected and safe. I am not entitled to goodness and grace always coming my way. I can, however, Masahide's poem suggests, stop in my tracks no matter what is going on in my life. And I mean no matter what. And receive the astonishing gift of the moon by simply lifting my eyes to gaze upon it. I am very grateful that I can see the moon. It's pretty basic. And as another Zen poet, which you heard quoted in Jane Hirschfield's fine poem on happiness, once affirmed, when you're hungry, eat. When you're sleepy, sleep. Rest and nourishment are as basic as the sight of the moon. Oh, sure, you can structure the basic things if you want. You can sleep at night from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. You can eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner at certain times of the day. But ultimately, that is all pretty arbitrary. Ask any night worker, for example. My parents in Detroit always told me as a kid to be home by dinner at 5:30, no later. That was dinner time. They also used to add, or else. I never had a problem with that, and I always showed up on time. I still think of supper time as something around 5:30, even though I rarely eat supper then. But someone with my exact birthday and birth year, who grew up in Argentina, is never going to think of 5:30 as dinner time, because in that culture, you don't eat until 10 p.m., period. Now, as a diabetic, I eat 6 meals a day, not the fabled 3. I eat smaller meals, usually scattered throughout the day in a very different way. It's healthier for me, keeps my blood sugar on an even keel, and my energy is greater because of it. I have different rules now. I make up the rules myself. Now, as the children's story made so clear to me this morning, and I hope to you, you need signs and rules to live out your life. If you get rid of them completely because you don't like some of them, you can make a big mess. Someone who takes the Zen poet literally and thinks it's okay to nap even while driving a car because you're feeling sleepy, well, might kill themselves, and us too. A person who is hungry here at the service this morning and decides to fulfill that hunger by bringing in a great big plate of spaghetti and meatballs with red sauce, spilling it all over the carpet and slurping, is going to cause unnecessary commotion. Best to follow the rules. Don't bring in any food. Don't bring any coffee and spill it all over the carpet. Leave it outside. No, the Zen poet was saying the same thing as the children's story was saying. Think. Think about the signs you follow, the rules you live your life by. Don't be rigid. Don't think any notion of right and wrong is exempt from your thoughtfulness. Just be honest about it. In Rabbi Chaim Stern's wonderful translation of the great Chinese scripture, the Tao Te Ching, that we read earlier this morning, we learn that unawareness of right and wrong is the mark of a mind at ease, just as unawareness of one's feet is the mark of shoes that fit. That's a very clear and practical metaphor, I think. Letting go of awareness of right and wrong as a series, a list of rigid rules that you have to follow because someone says so, that is displaced in the mind at ease by a different, more immediate kind of awareness. Attentiveness to the basics, to sleep, to nourishment, to kindness, to compassion, to fairness, and yes, to moonlight, sunlight, starlight, things we don't obey as rules, but simply feel and respond to. Now, sometimes when the word sin or the concepts of right and wrong are brought up in progressive circles like this, I may get a lecture on the evils of all those damn thou shalt nots. Don't do this, don't do that. Yet all these found in the Western scriptures. I'm told about the rule-bound negative nature of many of the biblical commandments. Fast from all food and sex on this day. Don't eat pork. Don't wear red. Don't eat shellfish. All these don'ts, people complain. Why can't you be positive? One person told me, I'm not so sure I believe there's a God someplace in the first place, but I sure as all get all don't think that any God worthy of the title would care when we eat, when we don't eat, and who we have sex with, or what colors we can wear. Those are all trivial rules. Well, perhaps to some, but I'm not sure such criticism is entirely rational. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it's not. After all, I have very good, intelligent friends who really appreciate the simple discipline of those rules, understood not rigidly, but expansively. You don't have to understand things rigidly, you know. The ancient rules, they tell me, help them to approach their lives with gratitude and not greed, grace and not grabbing. So me personally, I'm not going to complain about such things, say that everything's negative, which brings me back round to the beautiful definition of the word sin I quoted earlier. Sin is the seizure, the grabbing of life, as though by right, by entitlement, instead of receiving it as a gift. So even though the person who hurt me deeply this summer is not reachable anymore and is geographically far beyond any ordinary methods of justice or restitution, I have to come to this clear conclusion. I'm not living his life. I'm living my life. I'm responsible for my life. I am accountable to myself first. I myself feel that I was sinful in my intemperate reaction to him. My deep resentment and depression had to do with my sense of entitlement that such things should not happen to me, as if I was somehow different than everyone else and had special privileges. I would even say I spent a time this summer acting very childish, except that that would be a rather sharp insult to any child who happened to overhear me. And that, on this Sunday when we celebrate the insights of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, at one meant, brings me to the memorable words expressed by Christina Baldwin at the top of your order of celebrations. Forgiveness is an act of admitting that we are like other people. Forgiveness is the act of admitting that we are like other people. So I am like other people. I am like you, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you. My life too has ins and outs, ups and downs, joys and sorrows, mistakes and jubilation. Maybe something like yours. The details will be different. Our uniqueness is preserved. But the similarities allow for forgiveness. Sometimes your barn burns down, sometimes mine does. But the moon, basic as food and sleep, is above us all the time. And we can each look up to see it any time we so choose. And even though the ashes of our barn may still be smoking, we can find some more basic happiness, basic as sleep, food, and compassion, when we gaze up at that moon, our hearts emptied, emptied, emptied for a time of everything except gratitude. Because you and I are in many ways like each other in these basics, we can have the opportunity to forgive each other and ourselves. The folktale reminds us that forgiveness is not a magic trick. The phrase, "I forgive you," is often just a beginning, not the end. The beautiful ritual song we sing as a kol nidre does not restore relationship just like that. Mostly it serves to help us pry our fingers off the heavy weight of unforgiveness and deep resentment that any of us might be lugging around on any given day. No, to restore relationship, you have to do the work. You have to pick up the feathers you scattered, using the metaphor of the folktale. The gossip spread by the man about the rabbi was false, but it doesn't disappear like dew in the hot sun because it was false. Each word has to then be picked up I remember once being at a retreat where a colleague managed to say something in a sermon that he was giving to us that, hard as it may be to believe, hurt many, many of us. I mean, with clumsy skill, he managed to tear the scab off wounds that had been healing until he spoke. When he realized he had sinned against us, he asked me, one of the organizers, if he could have a moment with the gathered people to apologize to us all as a group for what he had done. I said, no, you cannot. You will have to go to each one of us individually and speak with each of us individually. Each hurt was uniquely felt, and there can be no ritual which magically restores everything. You have to do the work of restitution. It's not done for you by God or by a ritual or by anybody else. And to his everlasting credit, he did just that and restored a sense of community that had been broken, which is exactly what Jews have been saying about this ritual for hundreds of years. Happiness is not a magic trick effected by a beautiful melody. Happiness, using Hirschfeld's poem, is something that many things in our lives conspire against. Unreflective habits, customs immune to critique, systems of social and economic injustice, unconscious use of language, lack of forgiveness. So our best bet, I say, is to set a day aside to begin to empty ourselves as much as possible of our baggage and resentment. And then, when that's done, to begin again, knowing that it's just better to walk the way, the Tao, of a good heart, rather than crawl on the path of a bitter heart. My friend who got scammed by mail will get through it. It'll take him some time, but he will, just as I'm getting through my summer resentment. In the phrase of another poet, what happened really happened. What happened really happened. What happened really happened. But look, there's the moon.